You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, listeners.
Wednesday, 16th of April.
I was going to say 15th, but yes, you're right. It's the 16th. I'm always behind time. And in the studio today, we have
Nita,
Jesse,
and Sonia. I'm back after a week's holiday, so nice to be back in the studio with everyone.
Nice to have you back,
lovely
Sonia.
Lovely to have you back, Sonia.
And it was lovely this morning, I thought, driving in, because I obviously haven't been here since the clocks changed, and just seeing the sun rising, and there was the moon in the sky, and while they're, you know, there are problems with them, I do like the look of the hot air balloons in the morning sky. But, yeah.
No, they are beautiful. I have exactly the same thoughts on it. It's like, oh, look at those beautiful things, and, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Something else is happening here.
Yes.
I actually hate them. I hate how they're covered in advertising.
Yeah, I do hate that.
The fire just blowing into the atmosphere. But anyway, yes, I think if they had nice designs.
Yeah.
But the shapes are nice.
Yes. And it does provide, I mean, I felt that the tinge of optimism, if you like, in the morning contrasts quite a lot with what's happening in the world. We were talking just now about the pretty heavy emotional toll that world events are taking on, I think, all of us and our families and friends and everything. And just acknowledge that that's out there, despite how beautiful things might look. And, you know, the fact that it was 36 degrees where I was near Wangaratta this weekend.
Oh,
and it's mid-April.
Wow.
It's just insane. Apart from, you know, the
everything.
Politics and yes. Everything. So, yeah.
That still goes on. Yeah.
Wow.
And we are starting the news headlines with a couple of optimistic pieces.
Mm. Yes. But yes, I also just wanted to quickly say, it is kind of difficult at times when you're existing. And I think actually, if you're having a bit of a hard time, then that means you're probably a very good person.
Because you're a decent human being.
Because if you're existing and you're happy and everything's going well, and either maybe you're just not thinking about things too much, which is fair enough. But if you are thinking about lots of things and you feel good, then that's not a good sign.
That would be rather worrying. Agreed, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, if you're not miserable, you're not paying attention.
Shall we go to the news? Oh, shall we do a rundown of what's happening on the show first?
Yes. Good idea. So first up, I will play an interview I did with Marcus Rubenstein, who I actually interviewed on the show a few weeks ago, but we didn't have enough time to chat about everything that they wanted to contribute and that I wanted to talk to them about. So we made a time to have a bit of a longer conversation. And Marcus Rubenstein is a independent journalist of 25 years and currently has a column on the Pearls and Irritations public journal website, which is run by John Menadue. And it's called Anti-China Media Watch. So we're speaking about that, yeah.
And then we've got two other interviews lined up today, both relating to the upcoming elections. So the first one is with Lavanya Pant from 350.org. And I bumped into them. Well, they were running a Will's strategy meeting on the election. So she's going to be talking to us about the strategy for 350.org, which is a community climate group, 350 referring to the parts per million of carbon, that actually safe limit for carbon in the air. and talking to us about why this is an important election for climate and for the biological and ecological crises more generally. And then after the sort of 8 o'clock watershed, we'll be talking to Aaron from Médecins Sans Frontières. We've had him on the show with us before, but he's going to be talking about their Vote for Humanity campaign in the run-up to this election as well. So, yeah, an election-focused couple of interviews from me.
I had a visit from 350 to my house on the weekend. Mm-hmm. It was nice. I had a good conversation with them.
Lovely. Did you give them tea and biscuits?
I didn't invite them in, but now that I think about it, I should have invited them in. Yeah. Next time I will.
Right. Shall we go to the news headlines now?
Yes, news headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty gritty.
And these are the news headlines for Wednesday, 16th April 2025. 36 First Nations ancestral remains have been returned from the United Kingdom. Last week, 36 Indigenous Australian ancestral remains were repatriated from London's Natural History Museum in a ceremony attended by four representatives from three Queensland communities. Some remains were stolen from graves, while others were sent to the UK by institutions. Among them, four ancestors have been identified, belonging to the Wapaburra, Warragamme, and Wathati nations, while others' origins remain unknown. Warragamme man Thomas Holden, who attended the ceremony, condemned the theft of ancestors, comparing it to taking a grandparent out of the ground and putting them in a cupboard. He emphasized the deep trauma caused by their removal, some as early as 1907. The remains will now return to Australia, with unidentified ancestors undergoing further provenance research by the Queensland Museum. This repatriation marks progress, but challenges remain. Over the past 35 years, 1,300 ancestors have been brought home from the United Kingdom, yet the Natural History Museum still holds 200 Indigenous remains. The Australian government is assisting in returning some ancestors, while communities continue reclaiming their stolen heritage.
And Palestinian prisoner Ahmad Manasra has been released after nearly a decade in Israeli prisons. Ahmad Manasra, a Palestinian, was imprisoned for almost 10 years after being arrested at age 13 in 2015 for an alleged stabbing attempt in occupied East Jerusalem. His cousin Hassan Manasra was shot dead at the scene. Despite Israeli courts acknowledging he did not participate in the attack, he was initially sentenced to 12 years, later reduced to 9 years. He endured physical and psychological torture, including sleep deprivation and solitary confinement, since 2021, worsening his mental health. Instead of releasing him to his waiting family at Nafa prison, Israeli authorities dropped him in a remote Bedouin area near Beersheba. His family was banned from holding a public welcome. Only neighbors were allowed to visit, and media coverage was restricted. The case has drawn international condemnation, with rights groups criticizing Israel's treatment of Palestinian detainees.
And Israel has launched airstrikes across Gaza on Palm Sunday, killing 21 people, including children, and striking part of the last fully functional hospital in Gaza City. They severely damaged Al-Ahli Hospital, the last fully functional medical facility in Gaza City. The attack destroyed its intensive care and surgery unit, further crippling a health care system already in collapse. The World Health Organization warned of critical medical shortages as Israel has blocked aid deliveries for 6 weeks. This marks the second major attack on the hospital since October 2023, when an IOF strike killed 500 people early in the war, in the invasion or ongoing offensive and genocide. Backed by the US, Israel is advancing its ground offensive, creating a buffer zone along Gaza's border and forcibly displacing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians into shrinking coastal areas. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has intensified what critics call an ethnic cleansing campaign, combining mass killings, starvation tactics, and forced relocations. During a meeting with US President Trump, Netanyahu endorsed the proposal to expel Palestinians from Gaza, signifying further escalation. Israel is also detaining Asad al-Nasra, a Palestinian Red Crescent paramedic who has been missing since Israeli forces executed 15 aid workers on 23rd March. Witnesses described the massacre as a systematic killing, with victims shot at close range and buried in a mass grave. Nasra, a 16-year veteran medic, was reportedly taken alive and blindfolded by Israeli troops. The International Committee of the Red Cross confirmed his detention, raising concerns over Israel's targeting of humanitarian workers amid ongoing atrocities.
Australian weapon exports to Israel have been exposed. Israel's military has completed trials of an advanced weapon made by a Canberra-based defence supplier, which boasts its, quote, high precision and, quote, lethal product can strike targets up to 2 kilometres away. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation revealed that the remote weapon system designed and built by Australian company Electro-Optic Systems was one of dozens of counter-drone technologies tested by the Israeli occupation forces earlier this year. An Australian defense industry source claims the Australian-made components were first sent to Electro-Optic Systems in the United States to an entity of the Electro-Optic Systems in the United States for assembly before being shipped to Israel without an Australian export approval. The Australian-designed weapon was tested by the Israeli military early in 2025 as part of Israel's trials of, quote, counter-drone technologies. Despite the Australian government's repeated claims that no Australian weapons have been exported to Israel since October 2023, this revelation suggests that Australian components were sent to Israel via third country channels, specifically the United States, before being exported as a weapon system to Israel, bypassing Australian export controls and in violation of Australia's international legal obligations, including under the Arms Trade Treaty.
And leaked data confirms massive Israeli censorship campaign and Meta compliance, a sweeping crackdown on posts on Instagram and Facebook that are critical of Israel or even vaguely supportive of Palestinians was directly orchestrated by the government of Israel, according to internal Meta data obtained by DropSite News. The data shows that Meta has complied with 94% of takedown requests issued by Israel since October 7, 2023. Israel is the biggest originator of takedown requests globally by far, and Meta has followed suit, widening this net of posts in it automatically removes and creating what it can be called the largest mass censorship operation in modern history. Government requests for takedowns generally focus on posts made by citizens inside that government's borders, Meta insiders said. What makes Israel's campaign unique is its success in censoring speech in many countries outside of Israel. What's more, Israel's censorship project will echo well into the future, insiders said, as the AI program Meta is currently training how to moderate content will base future decisions on the successful takedown of content critical of Israel's genocide.
Attacking the largest camp for internally displaced people amid the world's largest displacement crisis in war-torn Sudan, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, killed over 100 people, including over 20 children, on April 11th. That evening, after hours of shelling from multiple directions, the RSF's troops broke into the Zamzam camp, where an estimated 750,000 displaced people have taken refuge. Burning down hundreds of their makeshift shelters, they also torched the famine-struck camp's central market and its community kitchen, burning the women inside alive, before attacking the last of the camp's medical posts and killing all its staff. Nine of our colleagues were mercilessly killed, including doctors, referral drivers, and a team leader. This is a profound tragedy for our organisation, Relief International said in a statement. This was a targeted attack on all health infrastructure in the region to prevent access to healthcare. The attack, which continued the next day and resumed on April 13th at noon, according to Adam Rojal, spokesperson for the General Coordination of Displaced Persons and Refugee Camps. These families, many of whom have already been displaced multiple times, are once again caught in the crossfire with nowhere safe to go, said Clementine Nkwati Salami, the UN's resident and humanitarian coordinator in Sudan. What is happening in Zamzam, Abu Shouk camp and Al-Fasha is not just a tragedy, it's an atrocity. Civilians are being starved, slaughtered and prevented from fleeing. Aid workers and local volunteer responders are being hunted, added the Sudan INGO Forum.
And finally, a 24-hour general strike against Milei's austerity was held in Argentina on the 10th of April. Argentina's trains and subways were disrupted, flights grounded, grain shipments interrupted, deliveries halted and banks shuttered as unions held a general strike on Thursday against the libertarian government of President Javier Milei. The day-long strike comes as Milei, 16 months into a presidency that has sought to eliminate Argentina's fiscal deficit through severe austerity measures. The stoppage, led by the country's main union confederation, CGT, tried to bring Argentina to a standstill a day after union activists joined a weekly protest of retirees rallying for increases to their government pensions, most of which are now set at the equivalent of some $300 a month and have lost significant ground to inflation. Union members, including train conductors, teachers, customs officials, trash collectors and postal workers, walked off the job at midnight on Wednesday for 24 hours. Airports emptied as the main airlines halted operations. Many public hospitals were only dealing with emergencies. The government said that the stoppage cost the economy some $880 million. And those have been the news headlines for the 16th of April, 2025.
And we'll head to a couple of community announcements and we'll be back in a minute.
Hi everyone, my name's Robbie Thorpe. I'm with 3CR Community Radio. Every year we have a subscription drive. It's a way of supporting our organisation maintain itself through the year, and we rely on the support of the community. One way to do that is to subscribe and become a member. Become part of this organisation itself. Get in contact with 3CR. You can go to the website 3cr.org.au or you can ring on 9419 8377. 3CR ensures that our voices, Aboriginal voices, are heard on this radio station. So it's a good way of supporting Aboriginal people as well by becoming a subscriber for 3CR Community Radio.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
And you're back with us on Wednesday breakfast. It's 18 minutes past 7. You could be listening to us on your radio, your old school, I don't know what to call it, the FM AM thing that you can bring around with you and you go around the house that we sometimes do at home, or maybe in the car, or maybe on the website on 3cr.org.au, on the playback service there, or on the community radio app, which is also an excellent way to listen in. And hello to everyone in the future. Hope you're having a great day. We'll go to an interview that I did with Marcus Rubenstein. Marcus Rubenstein is a independent journalist of over 25 years. He spent a bunch of time in China, actually, back and forth as a photographer. And he's currently, amongst other things, writing a regular column on the John Menadue Pearls and Irritations Public Policy Journal. And it's the title of that column is called Anti-China Media Watch. So we had a chat about that, why he's doing that, and also the current relationship and historically between the two nations.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Marcus. I really appreciate your time. Marcus, your full name is Marcus Rubenstein, an independent journalist with probably 30 years of experience, I'd say, a lot of time spent in China, many skills, photography, career in politics as well. But you know, the reason we're speaking today is in regards to your work in Pearls and Irritations and Michael West Media, as an independent journalist, and particularly focusing on China and countering some of the, maybe the more legacy, more common stories and narratives that we might be seeing, and trying to highlight and maybe make the truth more apparent through that work. So thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jesse.
So maybe we can begin by asking, you know, why did you start Anti-China Media Watch, and you know, what is your sort of view, overall view on the landscape here in Australia and perhaps more broadly in the West in regards to China, and you know, what's going on basically in Australian media in regards to China?
Well, the Anti-China Media Watch you refer to is a weekly column I've been writing for John Menadue's website, Pearls and Irritations. For those who don't know, John is the former head of the Prime Minister's Department under both Gough Whitlam, and then after the Whitlam dismissal for Malcolm Fraser. Those were back in the days when, you know, public servants actually worked in the public service. They weren't afraid to express political views. And even though Menadue was a Labor man and he'd worked for Gough as his principal private secretary when Gough was in opposition, Malcolm Fraser kept him on. And within, I think it was Fraser's first term, but within the Fraser prime ministership, John was then appointed as Australian ambassador to Japan. And one of the concerns John had at the time was that it was a point at which Japan was going through its rapid rise, much as China had done in the late 90s, early 2000s. And we were doing a lot of trade with Japan. We were buying a lot of Japanese goods, cars, electronic goods, whatsoever. At the stage John was there, because they were cheap, obviously, within a generation, people were buying Japanese stuff because it was very, very good. Mm. John was amazed at the level of ignorance about Japanese culture and Japanese business and Japanese people. I think there was a review of 500 companies doing business with Japan in Australia, and not a single one of them, and this is the mid to late 70s, not a single one of them had a Japanese-speaking manager or business executive, not one. Obviously, they relied on translators who simply were giving verbatim translations of dialogues, but there was no understanding expressed from the the businesses doing interacting with these Japanese companies. And it's, I wouldn't say it's the same today. At a government level, I think it's pretty much the same. There are people within government who understand Chinese culture and how to engage with China and how to perhaps better manage our relationships with them. But they're generally ignored. They're drowned out by the China alarmists and China skeptics within academia. When I say within academia, the academics are principally involved in strategic studies. I mean, you have a case where perhaps I won't mention him, but if someone wants to do a Google search, they could find out. You've got the National Foundation for Australia-China Relations, which was morphed out of the Australia-China Council, which was set up in the Whitlam era. It was set up so that Australians and Chinese could form a better understanding of each other, and effectively how to interact on a cultural level. It was about cultural understanding and people-to-people interaction. So it was reconstituted under the Morrison government when Maurice Payne was foreign minister. It was stacked full of China skeptics, to say the least, people who were very, very much opposed to the rise of China and who saw it only in this narrow parameter of being a geopolitical and military threat to Australia. Now, one of those people remains on the board. He's a professor in strategic policy at the ANU. And don't forget, the ANU people don't tend to realise outside of Canberra, it's the only university in Australia which is funded and set up by the federal government. So it has no, in terms of its operations, it is not independent of the government. It is in fact a government department, and they are accountable to the government. They're questioned, as they were quite recently in Senate estimates, and they were questioned. You know, that they were forced to answer questions that the Vice Chancellor, as to, you know, the appointment of consultants. And so they're agenda driven, and I think in this sort of post COVID or you know, during COVID, and perhaps immediately prior to that, let's say in the years leading up to that, you had you know, these China concerns began to be raised. They basically endorsed for the most part government policy, and academics within the ANU, and one in particular who I know reasonably well, were effectively, you know, shut down for expressing, you know, their views. I mean, there are very unpopular views to express if you're an academic, particularly at the ANU, on the issue of Taiwan, on the issue of Hong Kong democracy, of Tibet, of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province. I mean, these are very, very complex issues. And is the Chinese government right on all these issues, and does it handle them well? No, but is there a Chinese perspective? Yes, there is. And that perspective is pushed out. And you know, Xinjiang, for instance, which is in the west of China, it borders seven other countries: Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and I should know, but I can't name the others. You know, had a Uyghur population, which it had separatists engaged in a number of terror attacks, and the Chinese government clamped down on it. And the way they clamped down on it is they put a lot of these, you know, Uyghurs they regarded as extremists in re-education camps. They turned them around in the space of, you know, several years, not life internments. And in the meantime, whilst this happened, the United States declared the what's called the ETIM, the East Turkmenistan Independence Movement, which was the Uyghur independence movement, they declared them a terrorist group up until I think around about 2020 or the late 2010s, the Americans declared them as terrorists. And now the narrative's changed, and the American declares them as a persecuted minority. And meanwhile, how is it literally across the border? The US and Australia and the Britain and their allies were in Afghanistan under the guise of, you know, the response to terror and 9/11, killing hundreds of thousands of Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the hypocrisy is astounding. And that was that's a really key piece of information, I thought, not something that I had really understood, is the state and ANU connection. And how powerful that is in building policy and building the justifications for certain policies and excluding other policies, because it's all sort of funneled through the academic apparatus and through that research, and then that then dictates policy. And you can say, well, you know, it's all based on research, and it's all, you know, these are the experts and these academics in their field. And but then what you're saying and what the case is that actually, you know, the ANU and those academics are the government. It's not some kind of independent expert. It's very much influenced and controlled.
Look, I think there's a great deal of academic freedom there, but I think there's you know, there's also, because of government policy, there's sort of freedoms to roam off the reservation, if you will. I think the National Security School at the ANU does not, which is one of the more high profile, you know, schools within the university. I do not think they in any way exercise any rigorous research or reviews of positions. They come out with very particularly in relation to China, they come out with very lopsided opinions. And how a lot of these groups, I mean, they're very, in terms of their personnel and their opinions, they're very closely aligned with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, or ASPI, which is something we might come back to later. But ASPI is essentially, well, not essential. Well, ASPI is in fact a Commonwealth company, which declares itself independent of government. It's not. It's owned by the government, and its executive director, of which I think they're up to the fourth now in its history, the executive director is appointed by the defence minister. Now, when the defence minister appoints the boss of a Commonwealth company, they can hardly say we're independent of government. It's absurd. But the National Security College, you know, in many instances, you know, backs up and endorses the position of groups like ASPI, which are funded by the Defense Department, funded by foreign governments, by foreign weapons makers, and now increasingly foreign technology companies that have a vested interest in restricting China's rise as a technological power, particularly now in the era of AI. So, and these groups tend to sort of they mask their heavily anti-China bias with criticisms of the Australian strategic policies, but these are limited to, you know, it's to not that we want, and submarines, they're all lockstep with the government on AUKUS, but, you know, it's not that we need new tanks. It's what kind of tanks do we need? So they're not really, you know, they're tinkering around at the edges. So this, and this is how they proclaim themselves to be independent and engaging in serious thought and research. It's not, and really the only narrative they question in relation to our strategic issues is that we're not spending enough money on weapons, which is great from the point of view of someone like ASPI, who most of its sponsors, I mean, I wrote a piece several years ago, and through the life of their sponsorship of ASPI, through the life of ASPI at that stage, which had been 20 years since its founding, its sponsors had collectively picked up $50 billion in government contracts. Mm-hmm. So that's not too bad when, you know, when you're sponsoring a very, very high profile and influential strategic policy group, and you just happen to pick up billions and billions of dollars in Australian taxpayer funded contracts. It's not rigorous independent research. It's just heavily biased public policy influence, which is directing the Defense Department towards its sponsors and the weapons that they produce.
And so it comes down to, I guess, the interests of these large weapons manufacturers, along with, of course, we can't forget our friends in the United States, who are obviously very concerned with losing their I guess, stronghold on the global markets, and something that they haven't really had to deal with up until now, since they've sort of taken hold of the global market and, you know, post-World War II. And now it seems there is maybe a legitimate contender that could at least not really, I don't see China as kind of a competitor in terms of, you know, wanting to control the world markets themselves, but you know, at least someone that might try to challenge that unilateral control. And so that's kind of borne out in what's happening here. That's sort of the way I kind of make sense of the mainstream narratives coming from legacy media regarding China here.
Yeah, well, Henry Kissinger, the former U.S. Secretary of State and National Security Advisor in the Nixon administration, who depending on who you believe, and I subscribe to this point of view, was less a humanitarian and a great diplomat, which he's painted out, but just an out and out war criminal who greenlighted and ordered essentially the U.S. bombings, in Cambodia and across Indochina during the Vietnam War, countries that was not at war with, and resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands of people. But Kissinger famously said years ago, and I paraphrase, that to be America's enemy is very dangerous, but to be its ally is fatal. Yeah. And that's essentially Australia's China policy, and I think it's more apparent, or not necessarily, probably not apparent, but to those with a solid strategic understanding, it might be more apparent that Labor's policy, because I would argue that let's say since John Gorton and the remnants of the Menzies government during the Vietnam War, where you had Liberal National, or Country Party as they were known then, Liberal Country Party coalitions in power, that we were very, very pro-US, there was the line, I've got to be careful, I think it was Gorton, but it was, all the way with LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was Kennedy's successor after the assassination in 1963, which was a statement that Australia would do anything that America wanted to do. And of course it has, and it continues to do, and barring any major, political shift, it will continue to do. But, we follow America into these wars, and things have become very problematic. So since those Vietnam era, proclamations that we're with America, I think even more so than Howard, Albanese has drawn us much closer to the United States. And I think I might have mentioned this in our last discussion, but in a very dangerous way. The HMAS Stirling, the naval base outside of Perth, has now been opened up to US Virginia class nuclear submarines. Now, these are nuclear powered submarines, fair enough, but they're also, in all likelihood, in fact, almost certainly, even though it's not declared, a nuclear armed submarines. Mm-hmm. Similarly, with the Tyndall Air Base outside of Darwin, which the US is participating in the upgrades, so up to six US B-52 bombers can be stationed there. They are nuclear armed bomber aircraft. So Australia has very quietly, without consultation with with Parliament, or without debate in the Parliament, without consultation of the public, without any scrutiny by the media, even more disturbingly, we are a nuclear armed, middle power. Mm-hmm. And that, apart from the ethics of it, that there was no consultation by the Albanese government in terms of making us a nuclear armed state, we become a nuclear target. Mm-hmm. Heaven forbid, in the event of a nuclear war, we become with China, we become a legitimate target. And I think it would be foolish of us as Australians not to consider the Chinese will start, dropping nuclear bombs. And it's a terrible thing to say, but our best hope is that they just drop a nuclear bomb or a low nuclear bomb on Pine Gap or on the Tyndall Air Base, and heaven forbid they start dropping bombs on our cities. But if you think about, New Zealand, which has similar, geopolitical challenges with China, dealing with the issue of rising Chinese influence in the Oceania region, managing a substantial trade relationship. New Zealand's free trade agreement with China predates us by a couple of years, and it's gone through a number of substantial upgrades over that time. New Zealand manages it quite well. But against this backdrop, there's no way New Zealand has its legislated policy. They won't let nuclear armed foreign military hardware, be they vessels or aircraft, land in the country. But even if they were to have that, I mean, it's beyond the realms of consideration that there wouldn't be a debate about it and disclosure. But instead, in Australia, we've just allowed the US to slip in through the back door, and it's part of, very much part of, Albanese and the Labor Party's, strategy of not being seen, not being seen to be weak on national security. I mean, the particularly in this era of global hysteria, we've got the tragedy of the war in Gaza, the absolute mess of the Ukraine war, the saber rattling in Asia, over the South China Seas and the Taiwan issues. National security is a great, little flag-waving issue, and you can throw it up in someone's face. And the Liberals are generally very good at doing this. They're the ones traditionally tough on national security and strong on the economy. And these are the things they throw out there. Mm. So Albo and the Labor Party has been painted into a corner. And having said that, they've been painted into a corner, but in typical Labor government style, they've installed Richard Marles, Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister. Marles is he's no compromise Defence Minister, doing whatever it takes to defend the government from attacks from the opposition. Marles is a rabid pro-American, pro-military, China hawk politician. He is all the way with the USA, mm-hmm. and that's what we've got in government. And these are the politicians feeding the mainstream media with stories. Journalists in the Canberra Press Gallery no longer run around looking for stories. They get a phone call from ministerial advisors, and they get stories dropped in their lap. And when you've got deeply pro-American, ministers Richard Marles, dropping these stories, well, that becomes the political narrative, and that becomes the national hysteria.
And that was part one of a two-part interview I did with Marcus Rubenstein, who is the author of the weekly column on John Menadue Public Policy Journal Pearls and Irritations, and his column is named Anti-China Media Watch. We'll play the next part and final part of that next week. And now we'll head to a quick community announcement, and we'll be back shortly.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over, or we're going to move on over you.
Yellerman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
And now we've got on the line Lavanya Pant, who is from 350.org. She's the national organiser there. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Lavanya, despite the chaos in setting this up.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Pleasure. Now, the main reason that we've got you here is to talk a bit about the 350.org election strategy. But before we go into that, can you tell us a little bit about who 350.org are? And I really like your name, so perhaps we could start there.
Yes, so 350 actually stands for the parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere that is a safe amount to have. And it was a movement that started about 13 years ago when, you know, we were still there to keep it there. We've gone over that now. But yeah, but since then, the movement has turned into chapters all around the world. And so we've got 188 different 350s across the world. But in on this continent, in Australia, we have our own not-for-profit, and we run kind of independently because Australia has its own massive fossil fuel lobby that needs a completely different strategy. Yeah.
Great. And so obviously we have the elections coming up on the 3rd of May, and 350 has put together an election strategy. Could you tell us why you think that it's important to have a strategy for this election?
Yeah, I think this election's really key because, well, as you know, that we've opened, 30, almost 30 new coal and gas projects in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. And no matter which government, we're still seeing rampant coal and gas expansion by corporations. And I think there's this idea that climate has kind of taken a little bit of a backseat since COVID happened, and there's a cost of living crisis and many other issues have come up since. And but climate impacts just keep happening. And we're one of the biggest polluters in the world. So we do need, I think people do care about climate. It's just like we need to make it a top issue for candidates and key electorates, especially marginal electorates, so that people, they know that people haven't forgotten about this and that, you know, people are keen to elect a more climate-friendly parliament.
Now, could we just drill down into that? You say that we're one of the largest polluters in the world, yet we constantly hear, oh, China, oh, India, they're far worse than we are. We're just a tiny drop in the ocean in comparison to these guys. Could you just tell us why you're saying that Australia is one of the largest polluters in the world?
Yeah, well, we're actually the third largest polluter in the world just after Russia and the US. And the reason for that is our exports. So our export emissions outweigh our domestic emissions by 3-4 times. Mm-hmm. And our export emissions actually make up 5% of global emissions, which is like a really huge chunk of global emissions for a small country. And so, you know, we can blame other countries for it, but we're the one who's supplying the coal and gas. And we have no plan to stop it. And the International Energy Agency has said that no more coal and gas needs to be opened and should not be opened. It's not just a matter of science, which obviously says that we should not be open any more coal and gas if we want to, you know, not see increasing floods, fires, heat waves, and, you know, the hidden impacts on food, agriculture that's raising food prices and so on. We're not listening to the energy experts or the science.
And I guess that if you look at that in per capita terms, then we far outweigh even America and Russia.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the proportionality of it is actually huge, yeah.
Yeah, because we've got a much smaller population than either of those. You mentioned I hate the term cost of living, actually, because given that, you know, the reason why we're facing large price increases is partly because of price gouging by large corporations, in particular mm-hmm. the supermarkets and things like that. But let's just use it because it seems to be a shorthand that's got into every conversation at the moment. But what are the links between the cost of living and climate?
Mm-hmm.
Why is cost of living a climate issue?
Yeah, so cost of living, what does that actually mean? It means like rising rent prices, rising grocery prices, insurance premiums, and, you know, things like what other impacts do they have? You know, there's like rising gas prices. Mm-hmm. So now how everyone talks about supermarket price gouging, but people don't talk about the impacts of floods, increasing floods by cyclones on food and agriculture and how that's raising up food prices. And then also, you know, a cyclone happens in Brisbane and everyone across the country's insurance premiums go up, including for, you know, homes, not just homes, but also small businesses. And then with the housing crisis how we have at the moment, like I'm in Wills electorate, which is Marybeck, so it's in Nam. It's I'm in Faulkner, but Brunswick and Coburg are also part of it. Mm-hmm. And 11,000 houses are marked as flood risk. So, you know, how's that for a housing crisis? And then the most, and this is the thing that people don't realize, most of our gas is exported, and these, you know, while we have a gas shortage here, but countries like Japan are on selling our gas for profit. And so, you know, we say we have a gas shortage, but we're giving surplus gas to other kind of corporations for profit overseas, and that's raising up the prices here. So everything related to these not reining in these coal and gas corporations is just going to lead to a bigger so-called cost of living crisis in the future.
Let's stick for the start on the gas thing. So, I mean, we've had discussions about this on this show before, but I don't think it ever hurts to remind listeners and ourselves how much of our gas is exported and why?
I think it's something like 80% of our gas. So we've opened 28 to 30 new coal and gas projects. So, yeah, a large majority of that is exported. I can't tell you the exact number.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, something close to 80%. And why it's exported is, well, I mean, like, Australia has already enough gas to transition over the next 10 years to renewable energy. And, well, but gas corporations are just making windfall profits of rising gas prices. Like, after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there was, like, you know, the global markets did their thing, and there was a gas shortage, which just then leads to, you know, these companies just making windfall profits. There was a period where coal wasn't that doing that well on the market, but now fossil fuels are doing well again. So, yeah, so that means, you know, and also these gas companies and coal companies get subsidized by us and taxpayers.
I was going to say, but surely this is, they're making profits is good for all of us because we get that in our taxes and that helps to subsidize, you know, things like our schools and hospitals and things. Surely that's the case.
No. Well, that's not the case in Australia because we don't tax them nearly enough. So nurses in the last 10 years have paid $7 billion more tax than coal and gas corporations. And we also subsidise them with billions now. I don't know the exact number over the last 3 years because this information becomes available a bit more slower, like to a year or two later.
Mm-hmm.
But we have subsidised them by, you know, in the previous 3 years from 2024 on, before that, we had subsidised them by $14 billion over 3 years and they did not pay that much tax. So it makes no economic sense for us. It doesn't add up. And that's why it's, you know, we can see that our climate energy policy is dictated by these corporations and not by the science and what the people actually need to have a safe future.
And just to remind listeners, who's the biggest user of gas in Australia?
Okay, so the
leading question.
The biggest user of gas in Australia is actually the gas industry. So the gas industry uses gas to process gas to sell gas overseas. So LNG processing plants use a lot of gas, and so more so than consumers.
It's insane. Now, could you tell us a little bit about what you want out of the coming election and the strategy that you're using to get there?
Yeah, so we have a strategy. So we have an election campaign here in Wills in Victoria, and then also in Macquarie and Gilmore in New South Wales, as well as Richmond, and then Moreton in Queensland.
And why have you chosen those seats?
Yeah, so those seats are climate impacted, but they're also close marginal seats. So in Moreton, Richmond, and here in Wills, we have you know, a very small margin between the top candidates, which happen to be Labor and Greens. And then in the other electorates that I mentioned, the contest is between Liberals and Labor. Mm-hmm. So our strategy is different. Well, overall, you know, we want to push people, we want to engage people and voters to vote in a more climate-friendly way, and also to show that all candidates that are running, that climate is in fact a big issue. But then so in places like, you know, Victoria and the seat in Queensland, so coal and gas is a big issue. Like, you know, we can keep opening a billion new renewables and the candidates do have policies for renewables, but if we keep opening coal and gas, we're not going to protect our communities from climate impacts. So that's the strategy and that's the message here, that we need to phase out coal and gas. And other parts of the country, well, it's just, you know, like Peter Dutton has these plans to, you know, like nuclear plants, and which are highly dangerous and unsafe. Nuclear is highly unsustainable, and, you know, uses a nuclear reactor uses 1 million litres of, or if that, like, I think even more, many million litres of water a day. So
it's so, radioactive that even he stopped talking about it, which is great.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, so our strategy is basically to overall push all candidates in the hope that voters will elect a more climate-friendly parliament, because we're out there in the community engaging them on the issue. And we don't really, we're non-partisan, so we don't really endorse a candidate, but what we do is make sure that all candidates are being pushed and to adopt a policy that is, you know, in favour of our climate and our future and the people.
And how successful have you been so far?
Well, I can speak mostly for Wills. We've done really well across the country, but in Wills, we've spoken to hundreds of people. And, you know, no matter where you go in the electorate, there's areas in the south that are slightly more climate concerned. Cost of living is a bigger issue in the north. But then when you tell people that, you know, we have opened 30 new coal and gas projects and these companies get billions from us, that people are shocked regardless of, you know, what their top issue is. So that message has been working to really engage people. And then, you know, we had a launch a few months ago in all these electorates, and we've had 100 plus show up, people show up to many of these. And then, you know, here in Brunswick, we had 100 and something people show up. And people are really engaged. People want to take on more action. People are volunteering. We're mostly volunteer run. So people are out there engaging the community. And some other tactics, I mean, you know, we've been out there talking to candidates out in public. We've been asking them these questions in forums. And now the biggest thing is pre-poll. So a bunch of our electorates, we are pre-poll. Most voters actually decide their vote on the day. And most voters are now voting on pre-poll. So we really want to be there handing out our scorecards so people have a good idea of the climate policy of each candidate and how we've rated them. And so they can make an informed decision when they vote. So that's the pre-poll opens next week. So that's the next big thing that we're doing.
And just so listeners know, the ACF, I think yesterday, released their scorecards, which cover all the parties and candidates across the country. So that's available at acf.org.au. ACF, of course, is the Australian Conservation Foundation. And I suspect there's quite a bit of overlap in the issues that they care about and the issues that 350.org is campaigning on. So just as an aside there. Sorry, I was also wanting to ask you a little bit about, I've completely lost my train of thought here. Is there anything else that you would like listeners to do in the next few weeks?
Yeah, I think if listeners are in our electorates, you know, marginal electorates, so that's Wills here, Coburg, Brisbane, Brunswick, Carlton, Faulkner in Victoria, and then we've got Moreton in Queensland, which is in Brisbane as well. And then we've got the Blue Macquarie, Blue Mountains, Hawkesbury, Gilmore, Yorubadella, that area, and also the Byron Bay and Mullumbimby. So if you're in those areas, you can actually get involved in the campaign in the next week or so. And, you know, the next 2 weeks are going to be really crucial in engaging as many people as possible. But if you are not, you know, you can still put up a yard sign. So we've got yard signs that say, that have our messaging on it. But also, you can just look at a scorecard online. And as you mentioned, ACF scorecard has ratings for all the candidates and parties everywhere. So you can share that with your friends. You know, you can have a chat to your neighbours about it. And yeah, so that's a way to engage your community as well.
Great. And we'll make sure that we put the 350 website into the show notes today. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks so much, Sonia.
And that was Lavanya Pant, who is the 350.org national organiser, talking about the reason why climate is still a priority in this upcoming election and how you can help to shape your candidate's climate policy. Interestingly, I was listening to a podcast with Richard Dennis from the Australia Institute, who reckons this will be the last climate election because the uptake of renewables is such that we won't be even worrying about it by the next election. So I think that was an optimistic take on things.
Really? We won't have to worry about it? That's great.
I hope that that's the case.
Yeah, me too.
Shall we go to a community announcement now?
Yeah, we'll be back in a minute.
It will not address the deep underlying issues that still pervade Australian society. And that primary issue is white Australian racism.
We've got a clear-cut case here of intentional genocide from the get-go, from the round table in England.
The true history in this country isn't told. The government always say that they're committed to a truth-telling process. Well, where is your truth-telling process?
I really believe that at the end of the day, the truth will emerge. You can't fight against the truth. It's an unstoppable force. It's indestructible. So deal with it.
3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
I think Welcome to Country is a very dangerous concept and initiative. I really don't know where Welcome to Country even merged from. I know that I don't think it was obviously an Aboriginal initiative. I think obviously governments had introduced that as they were pacifying our flag of resistance. You know, the idealism that lies behind that obviously is so that white people can feel a sense that they're more guests and they've got a right of ownership and to be here. If we're going to continuously welcome them to country, what that does, it rectitudes the fact of the moral racism issues in which they perpetrate against our people. Because how can we be talking about all these other issues and then compromise a hypocrisy in our own selves to welcome these murderers and these slave traders and this barbaric sense of what they've done to occupy Australia on one hand and welcome them on the other?
You're listening to Radical Radio 3CR.
CR Community Radio is dedicated to exploring the issues that affect our future.
Because I think it is something we just need to be talking about.
855 AM. Tune in and listen up.
FreeCR is radical radio, and that means more than just alternative current affairs and political coverage.
We're radical because we're an independent media outlet owned and operated by the community.
We're radical because we give communities the control of their own shows, with their own music, in their own languages.
We're radical because we provide a media platform for communities to build their own power to create social change.
Become a subscriber and support Radical Radio. Call us on 03 9419 8377 or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Good morning, everyone. You're listening to 3CR 855 AM. It's Wednesday, the 16th of April, and we're about to chat with the Humanitarian Affairs League from Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, Australia, Aaron Jagan. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Sonia.
You're here to talk to us a little bit about MSF's election strategy for the upcoming election. Why has MSF decided that it's important to have a strategy for this one?
That's a really good question. And so, yeah, MSF this year has decided to have a election strategy because we believe that this election is quite critical. So our campaign right now is calling on Australians to prioritise humanitarian values in the 2025 federal election. We're really encouraging people to talk to their candidates and asking them to commit to compassionate refugee policies, fair foreign aid, and climate leadership. We believe that this election is super critical because right now, you know, I've worked in over 10 countries for MSF. In Bangladesh, you've got the world's largest refugee camp. That's right on our doorstep. You've got Myanmar's going through a civil war right now. I've recently run malaria and dengue programs in the last 3 years where we've seen shifting patterns of mosquitoes and the disease due to climate change. So the problems of today will really require the next Australian government to take a humanitarian approach to all this. And we think that it's in the best interest for Australia to do this. So we're asking our 500,000 supporters of voting age in Australia and all the people who are following MSF to really ask their candidates to support these foreign policies.
And so tell us a bit about what's your campaign called and what are the main demands? You've touched on it a bit there, but what are the main demands that the campaign is making?
Great. So our campaign's called Vote for Humanity, and we're really trying to put humanity on the ballot to rise above party politics and rise above party politics and policies that affect millions around the world. So the three main areas of advocacy that we're trying to look at is a compassionate refugee policy, fair foreign aid, and climate leadership. And within them, we've got, you know, quite a lot of different messages that we'd like to see Australia do. So we'd like to see Australia. We'd like to see Australia improve its refugee policies by ending offshore detention, reducing the people who are left in limbo, and giving refugees a fair chance. We're also encouraging the Australian government to increase its foreign aid. Currently, its aid is well below global standards. We only give about 0.68% of our federal budget to overseas aid, and that's far short of the 1% that is expected of countries like Australia. We see, you know, record global displacement all around the world. Around 122 million people were projected to have in 2 years. So Australia must really rise to meet its international obligations. Now, we do believe that Australia has done a fair bit. You know, we see that Australia has increased its refugee intake. It has contributed at scale to providing aid to countries like to Myanmar and Bangladesh, but we do think Australia needs to do a lot more. And so we're asking Australians to really vote for to put in a government that places humanity at the top of the ballot.
Now, you talk about politics of compassion, which seems sadly outdated at the moment. Compassion hardly seems to focus on the agenda at all. But you, in the materials, you also talk about policies of self-interest. Why is compassion in our self-interest?
So we really believe that, you know, supporting refugees and providing humanitarian aid, it isn't just charity. It's really smart long-term policy. It'll assist in creating stability in our region, in the Asia Pacific. It'll stop the prevention of disease outbreaks, and climate resilience will benefit all Australians directly. You know, the climate crisis is not something that's happening overseas where in very poor countries. Of course, it's disproportionately affecting people who don't have the resources to deal with it. But we've seen it in Australia. We've seen the bushfires. We've seen the floods happen in Australia. So a good climate policy, a robust climate policy, will affect Australia immediately as well. So as we put it, you know, this is not about the left or right of politics. It's really about what is humane, and it's something that we believe all Australians can really get behind. Compassion's a really important one, I think. You know, you're talking about this world right now, which we're seeing a bit of a lack of compassion. Some of the aid cuts that we've seen overseas by the US and the UK really doesn't assist in this kind of compassionate viewpoint that we'd like the world to have. But you know, we're really grateful that this year that fear and division hasn't completely dominated the debate, particularly around refugees and migration. Mm-hmm. But the absence of talking about progressive refugee policy is also not a good one. We want to create a culture that doesn't see refugees or people of color as security problems that need to be locked up. We want to see them as...
Or stealing our housing.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, major parties still support this securitized immigration policies, but, you know, Australians in 2002, they showed that they're open to different independent and values-based alternatives. So we want the major parties and all parties really to take humanitarian policies off the table, and that means working together on a common platform which sees climate, humanitarian aid, and also the refugee policy put first in a humane way.
And I'm just going to take this opportunity to quote Lila Watson, because I think this is such a beautiful quote. If you've come here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let's work together. And I think that we all have a future that's bound up together. It's one planet that's just tiny in the universal scheme of things, and we should be doing the best that we can to work together, because liberation is only works when everybody gets it. But I'd also like to talk a little bit about what I think are the two big elephants in the room, the US policies and Gaza. So let's start with US policy. How is that affecting the way in which discussions are being framed, and also what room we have to manoeuvre here in Australia?
Very good question, and I think it's important to address what's going on with the US policy. So, you know, the world is, as we know, is being reshaped before our eyes, and not in particularly good ways. The US AID cut, that's over $40 billion worth of aid that has been taken out of the world. And, you know, we've talked about 110 million people currently who are forcibly displaced. We're talking about millions of refugees, children threatened by malaria, and people who need HIV and tuberculosis treatment, all of whose care have been stopped. So taking away $40 billion from the global humanitarian system, it's an unmitigated disaster. Mm. What I'm really afraid of right now, and what MSF is afraid of, is other political parties and nations looking to this example and doing the same. It's not just the US. The UK is also doing it too. Other countries are seeing that as well. Now is not the time to limit humanitarian aid, especially from wealthy countries like Australia and the US and other places. This is exactly why humanitarian aid should never be political. What does that say about society, right? Like, because if, you know, it's the sudden freeze in international assistance. We know of people who have lost their source of medical care overnight. They've come to our clinics in Bangladesh saying, we no longer can access these clinics because they've shut down. So these changes are reverberating across the communities where we work. I think, you know, on a bigger scale, what I'm more scared about this is the tone that it is setting. I think you really mentioned something previously, the quote that you mentioned. What does this tone mean? What does this culture mean that we do not believe in the collective humanity of all of us, that we're all connected? That humanity that makes me care about my neighbors. You know, if a person in Gaza goes hungry because of conflict, that impacts me. If a Rohingya person in Bangladesh has their food rations cut to now potentially $6 a month, you know, that makes my life poorer. And I think this is the sort of generosity, care, and kindness that we expect from our leaders, to care about other people in this world. It will only make our lives better. And that's talking a little bit about the US one. I'm happy to also talk about Gaza, as you touched.
Yes, please. We do talk about Gaza quite a lot for obvious reasons in this show. But yeah, what is the MSF position, and what would you like to see the political parties and candidates be saying about Gaza?
Right, and I think there has been a real, you know, the war in Gaza right now has been in the background of all the discussions that we're talking about right now. Mm. There's a feeling in the air that, you know, some people aren't talking about it anymore because it's just too difficult. Many communities are also very disillusioned by the political parties' responses, especially on calls around the ceasefire and humanitarian access. How is it that the global international community has allowed for nearly a year and a half of war that has destroyed all the functioning hospitals or at least reduce them to only partly functioning, killed over 51,000 Palestinians and over 1,000 Israelis, and having politicians in Australia even talk about undermining institutions like ICC and ICJ and the International Criminal Court and ICJ, undermining the very conventions of international humanitarian law, giving Israel the cover to pursue what we believe is ethnic cleansing in Gaza. You know, how has that happened? How has that culture happened? I think we expect a lot more from our leaders. We expect our leaders to abide by these international principles like international humanitarian law, which says you cannot kill civilians in the pursuit of military targets. You cannot kill aid workers. You have to allow aid in. You cannot use aid as a bargaining chip for political discourse. You know, right now we're seeing blocked borders in Gaza, that trickle of aid being allowed let through. These are all human-made catastrophes. This can change if there is enough international pressure. And we believe, you know, Australia has made some steps forward in that direction, but all political parties need to commit to this. It has to be an depoliticized issue, especially when we're talking about the killing of over 50,000 people in this conflict. I think the horrific killing of the aid workers recently is just yet another example of the complete disregard shown by Israeli forces for the protection of humanitarian and medical workers. And so this silence and unconditional support of Israel's closest allies really embolden these actions. So we cannot ignore these links, I think. And I think people in Australia will be having this in mind when they vote this year. And I think the politicians can do a much better job at addressing these head on.
That's great. Is there anywhere that listeners can go to find out more, or if you've done something like scorecards or ratings of parties or anything like that?
Yes, you can go on our website, where we have a landing page where we've written down all our key messages that people can send to their candidates. You know, we're not asking people to vote in any particular direction. We're just asking them to talk to their candidates, to say that these issues matter to them, that refugees, that increased humanitarian aid and climate policies matter to them. And, you know, politicians have to listen to their constituents. So make your voice heard, make your vote count. We believe going to our website and downloading that that letter can give you a good head start in what is really should be an exciting time for all Australians to choose a government that they believe in, to choose a government that they believe will be the best for themselves and the world.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Aaron. And we will make sure that we put that link into our show notes. That was Aaron Jagan, the Humanitarian Affairs Lead from Médecins Sans Frontières Australia, talking about why we should be voting for humanity in this upcoming election. And it ties in nicely with the previous interview because climate change is a human issue. It's an issue that's going to affect not just the people on this planet, but the ecosystems upon which we rely.
It's all interrelated. Yes, yeah. Very much so.
And I'm just going to pull up another statistic here that came from the Palestinian NGO network. 350,000 people in Gaza are currently classified as being in phase 5 of famine, which is the highest phase of the IPC, I'm not sure what that stands for, acute food insecurity scale, and is classified when an area has deaths of two adults or four children for every 10,000 people each day due to outright starvation or to the interaction of malnutrition and disease. So that's a horrific statistic and one that we should be taking into the ballot boxes with us.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks, Sonia. We might go to a song. This is No Justice, No Peace by Lakim Shabazz. And that was No Justice, No Peace by Lakim Shabazz. That recording was 35 years old. It was released in 1990. Lakim Shabazz is part of the Flavor Unit crew that included artists that you might know, like Queen Latifah, and all the music was made by 45 King back in the day from New Jersey. And Now I think we might head to some community announcements. We've got a few things to share today, including on just tomorrow. There's a couple of things on tomorrow. One of them is a led by LASNET, the Latin American Solidarity Network, and the Forest Conservation Victoria, who are calling for support for the release and dropping of charges against Indigenous land defenders in Cotabamba in Peru for protesting against MMG's copper mine on their Indigenous lands. MMG are also pursuing crippling fines of over US$85,000 in, quote, compensation for the defenders. And so that that action is led by the Forest Conservation Victoria and LASNET will take place tomorrow afternoon from 4 to 5:30 p.m. at the MMG HQ, the headquarters at 24/28 Freshwater Place in Southbank. You can just Google LASNET and you'll be able to find a bit more information about that. But before that, tomorrow as well, at 12:30 p.m., Vixen are holding an action where there's it's about Asian migrant sex workers who are being targeted by violent and racist raids under Operation Inglenook from the Victorian police. So they're, Vixen are calling for supporters to come out to 808 Burke Street in Docklands tomorrow at 12:30 p.m. And on Saturday, Anakbayan, so Anakbayan are the revolutionary youth Filipino group. They're calling out for people to come and help them build a giant effigy, a massive puppet kind of paper mache creation. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but they put out a call out for support. So you can check out the Anakbayan Instagram page for more information on that. And we have an interview coming up with Anakbayan hopefully next week. And we'll learn more about the work that they are doing and the international work, as well as what's happening in the Philippines. It's a very interesting and very powerful collective.
And on Saturday at the Black Spark Cultural Centre, there is an art exhibition, or the exhibition open night by Fizz McHugh called Lipstick on a Pig. And there's a picture of the cartoon there with a rather porcine looking Peter Dutton in the frame. is that all that we've got? Do we have any more community announcements? There is also the Palestinians Don't Need Sidewalks film screening happening next Thursday at 6:30. I can't read where that's happening. Can you see that, Nita?
It's happening at Cinema Nova on Ligon Street, and that will be at 6:30 p.m. next Thursday, 24th of April.
And part of that was filmed here at 3CR. So do head along to that. It's about genocide, complicity, resistance in the context of what's happening in Gaza at the moment and in Palestine. I think that's probably it for community announcements today. So today on the show, we had... most recently, we had Aaron Jagan, the humanitarian lead for Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders here in Australia, talking to us about their Votes for Humanity campaign and why compassion is about is self-interest as well as mutual aid. Before that, we were talking with Lavanya Pant from 350.org about their election strategy, and we'll probably be having more about the election strategies of various community groups in the run-up to the 3rd of May elections. But they were talking about why we need to vote for candidates who put climate first, and we will be having a link to the scorecard that they've put together for Wills, as well as to the Australian Conservation Foundation scorecard in our show notes.
And First up, the first interview that we had this morning was an interview with independent journalist Marcus Rubenstein, who is the author of the weekly column Anti-China Media Watch on John Menagie's Pearls and Irritations Public Policy Journal. And we spoke about basically the relationship between China and Australia and the links to defence and the ASPI, the think tank that really is behind a lot of these policies and the the foreign policy here in Australia. Yes, and that was the first part of two parts, so we'll play the next part next week as well.
And that's all for us from us this week. Thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. Thanks to all our guests for giving us their time and their passion and their courage. And coming up next is Stick Together.
Yes, have a wonderful day, everyone. And we'll see you or hear you. You'll hear us and we'll speak to you next week.
Bye-bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.